Welcome back to the most fabulous podcast in the world, Paris Lesbos. Thank you for listening wherever you listen to podcasts. And today, we're abandoning France for the United States. In a very odd turn of events, we're taking the theater life from Salt Lake City, Utah, and the Mormon community.
Of all things.
Yes, for today, we're doing Maude Adams. So we begin in Salt Lake City, November 11th, 1872. Maude Adams is born to the actress Annie Adams and James Kiskaden, a descendant of the Mayflower and not at all a Mormon.
Interesting. So then why are they in Mormon country?
Because Annie Adams is from a Mormon family.
Which is kind of weird, because I don't usually see them as, like, actors or, you know, being connected to the theater arts. That sounds very sinful for their kind of frame of mind.
You would think that, and yet there's a history of Mormons acting. Apparently, before Annie was born, play acting, as it was called then, was introduced to the Mormon community.
Interesting. And not just introduced, it sounds like, but actually embraced by. Yeah, what did Mormon acting look like? Was it the same as, like, normal theater, or was it kind of partitioned off and separate? Because I know a lot of their culture is kind of partitioned off from the greater U.S. culture.
Well, I haven't found anything about what sort of plays they put on. I'm assuming nothing that would offend the church. What I do know is that under Joseph Smith, he actually had a theater erected, as well as a dance hall.
Interesting. Yeah, so this is a different form of religious fundamentalism than others in the U.S. He's not saying that any of these things are not allowed. They're just allowed in the right ways, I guess.
Now, before Maude was born, there were also twin stillborn boys in 1871. So Maude is the youngest of a total of three, but she's raised as an only child because she's the only one that survives.
But it sounds, from the way that you say that, it sounds like the two older brothers she could have had a big part to play in her life, nevertheless.
Not exactly, though her parents would obviously mourn her older siblings, I think especially her father, as we will see. This isn't the most stable of families.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, her stage debut actually occurs before the age of one.
Right, because her mother is an actress. So what is her debut?
So when she's only 9 months old, she substituted for an actual actor who was a two-month-old infant and was carried onto the stage on a platter where the audience applauded as she curiously cooed at them.
So the backstory... an actual actor who is 2 months old, I'm just going to say, how well-trained is that baby? Is she really qualified enough to understudy this talented actor there?
Well, you see, the stage manager or producer actually wanted an actual infant rather than a rag doll. And the two-month-old was actually very well behaved up until, like, right before this scene where he was putting up a fuss. So Maude, who was visiting her mother, who was in this play, was whisked onto stage as a substitute.
I love it. That's very cute. So do we know if her acting then was something that she felt kind of natural in because she'd been exposed to it so early?
Does a 9-month-old really have that kind of capacity?
No, but I mean, if that's where you start, I would imagine that as you grow up and you continue to have connection to the stage, that it... there would never be a point where you'd be like, ah, this is my first interaction with acting as a career, you know, because you'd encounter it so regularly.
Yeah, she grew up with acting, with the theater. She was always surrounded by it.
That's pretty cool.
And then her mother went and moved the entire family to San Francisco in order to continue her own acting career. And she would later bring Maude onto the stage in children's parts, starting at the age of 5. Much to the chagrin of her father. This is probably what caused her to adopt the stage name Maude Adams.
And probably, not her father's name.
Well, her legal name was Maude Kiskaden.
Right, her father's last name. But I guess she liked the stage and her father didn't like that she liked it. Is that what you're saying?
Maude did love the stage. Her father did not like that her mother let her go on so young and so often. There's also the fact that Annie Adams is performing under the name Annie Adams, has been for a while, so if Maude is her daughter, it makes more sense to capitalize on the Adams name rather than to be Maude Kiskaden.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. I've heard of a lot of people, like stars today, who will use the last name of the more famous actor parent. But I bet that the father then, that would kind of be an insult to injury sort of thing, where both that his daughter is going on stage and he doesn't want that, and also she isn't even using his name, you know, and his wife isn't using his name, seem kind of emasculating to me. But I don't know if I'm just making things up there.
Yeah, add in the fact that his twin sons are dead.
Right, so he doesn't have sons to raise in whatever. What is his business that he would be raising his sons in if he had them?
So James Kiskaden, for a long time, worked in a bank, or several different banks.
Mm-hmm. So, a lot more respectable and mainstream.
Yes, though James and Annie Adams would separate, though they never thought of divorce.
Why not?
I suppose, though, or just that it was not done.
Mm-hmm. Right, so it was just not a possibility. Yeah, so they didn't divorce, but when did they separate? How old was Maude?
Maude is still a child, because it's about this time in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so that sounds like a big upheaval in her life, that she's no longer the place that she grew up in, and now her parents are separating. Who did she live with? What did she end up doing?
So she lived with her mother. A maid occasionally looked after Maude. Her father moved into a boarding house in the city.
Mm-hmm.
He also turned to drinking.
Oof. Oh, no.
Yeah, this is probably part of what led her mother to take her on tours more away from him.
Mm-hmm. Right, not have as much exposure to that. It's ironic that her father didn't want her to go on stage and be exposed to the deviance of the stage when here he is getting into drink and probably not being a good person for a child to hang out with.
So we don't really know, considering the circumstances, what sort of relationship she had with her father. Her recollections, though, were always positive, like love, caring, and respect. A very romantic vision of her father, compared to the reality of a despondent man who's drinking himself to death.
Mm. I'm glad at least she got that positive image, you know, rather than having something that would be hurtful to her, that she had something positive to look back on. But I imagine, too, since she's touring with her mom a lot, she could then be thinking back on her father, you know, as a distant memory rather than an everyday thing.
Yes, she also wouldn't be there when he died. Her mother would take her at age 9 east with a new stage company.
Mm-hmm. So, and how was touring for her at such a young age?
So she enjoyed it, but it must be noted that the conditions on trains and in touring small towns then were not the best.
Mm-hmm.
Sleeping cars sometimes only had rudimentary hard seats. You would feel every bump. The windows, if they were open, would let in cinders and dust from the engine. The housing you would get a lot of the time would have sagging springs and lumpy mattresses, no closets, no bath.
Love it. So I'm sure it all smelled great.
She enjoyed the adventure, though. It was also on this trip that Charles Frohman enters the narrative. So Frohman was a theater manager who would go on to work closely with Maude much later on. At the time, though, he didn't have work for either actress, so her mother decided then to send Maude to school back in Salt Lake City, where she would live with her maternal grandmother.
Hmm. How did she like that after the whirlwind pace of touring?
She objected very strongly to this.
Mm-hmm.
So she would attend the Collegiate Institute and would be seen as very shy and self-conscious. She didn't leave the theater behind, though. She turned her grandmother's attic into a makeshift theater.
Yeah, I would imagine that she wouldn't have a lot of friends there initially, at least, because she hasn't been there for so long. So probably it's pretty hard for her to relate to the other kids who have not had this kind of background.
Yeah, it was also, I'm not sure if I made this perfectly clear earlier, it was during this time that her father would die because her mother, she returned briefly to San Francisco where James had remained. She still didn't live with him. He was truly an alcoholic by now and had been arrested multiple times for disorderly conduct. Naturally, Maude was not told any of this.
Mm-hmm. Did she learn about it later?
Possibly. We do know that James died on September 21st, 1883, and that his body was then shipped back to Salt Lake City. He may have died of pneumonia as a consequence of alcoholism. Now, Maude was told that he died, probably not under the circumstances of his death or anything. She was inconsolable for a time. Her mother was relieved, by contrast.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. It sounds like that would have been a difficult thing to be hiding from your child, that their other parent is slowly succumbing to alcoholism.
Maude stayed at the Collegiate Institute for 4 years. By the time her mother went to San Francisco in 1886, she was itching to get out of educational monotony.
So she wasn't learning a whole lot in her school, despite its impressive name?
I think it's more she wasn't paying as much attention as she probably should have been.
Gotcha. So she had the theater bug and she was not going to be cured of it by being sat down in a formal institution.
No, so only a few months later, her mother let her join her in California. In 1887, at age 14, she returned to the stage and she would now be in ingenue roles. Admittedly, she had trouble finding her own personality amidst all the roles as she grew up. She wrote this down later in an essay that she wrote in the third person called The One She Knew Least.
Which was herself. Interesting. Yeah, and that sounds more like what a character actor would do, that they would kind of become part of their the various eccentric and different characters that they played rather than playing themselves every single time. But on the other hand, I would imagine that on an ingenue, you don't have to do too much. You just have to be innocent and pretty, right?
You still have to act. And well, act yeah. Well.
But I mean, as opposed to, I don't know.
Anyway, she finally gets a lead role in 1888 in The Paymaster. So the role is as Ethel Miley. It required the actress to be dunked in water each night, and the original actress refused and left. Maude had already memorized all the lines and took the role when the company was in Kansas City, though her mother insisted on taking her place each night for the dunking.
Oh, that's nice of her, at least.
By the time they got to Brooklyn several months later, Charles Frohman had worked for Maude in a small play, one that required her to learn the role within a week. She agreed, went to Boston, and played in Lord Cholmondeley, an Edward Southern play. So by the time she got to her first rehearsal, she had actually already memorized the part.
She sounds like a real overachiever when it comes to acting.
She kind of is. Southern, though, recalled her as being, like, slim and having a childish figure dressed in a summer frock. And though she had memorized the part, he took it upon himself to help her practice her facial and body expressions.
So she's getting expert tutelage, I guess.
Yes, well, he's the one who would chide her for not opening her lips far enough and working with her to speak more with her mouth and to laugh better. He would actually offer classes on laughter, and Maude actually would credit her laughter techniques later on to Southern.
Her laughter techniques? I mean, how do you even do that intentionally?
My dear, I'm a writer, not an actress. You're asking right. The wrong person.
That sounds like a lot, though, to be studying and thinking about.
Anyway, he is the one who would nickname her Mrs. Midget. Mm-hmm. Because she was small, elf-like, elusive, and mysterious, according Ooh. To him. Love. She called him Mr. Oldest because he always seemed to be playing old men's parts.
But was he old?
He was middle-aged by then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that does happen a lot, where people play people who are, like, 30 years older or younger than they're supposed to be. Because, you know, they're the person who works for the part, Are they the person that the director likes working with, or things like that?
The play returned to New York by the end of the year, where her mother joined her before the paymaster ended its run and they were forced back to San Francisco for lack of work in early 1889. Now, we get her first real break, a role in A Midnight Bell by Charles H. Hoyt. It's an instant success, though the installation of electricity midway through the run causes a few issues, namely sporadic blackouts. There was There was also the fact that a minor political society tried to get Maud off the stage. Because they thought she was under 16, and you had to be at least 16 to perform.
I mean, that's a good motive, because there are a lot of child labor issues, even still today, among actors, where sets will push actors to work longer and without breaks than they legally should be. So it's good to advocate the rights of young actors, but she was older at the time, right?
Yeah, she was in her late teens.
Her heart was in the right place.
Yeah, so now, at 17, Maud's acting ability had changed and improved. She changed her voice and movement to fit the character's personality after spending weeks focusing on living the part and imagining how she would react in each circumstance, practicing every little gesture and expression, probably helped by the fact she had no social life.
Wow, yeah, so she is still lonely after all this time. I guess that makes sense because she's been moving around a lot.
Yes, well, her mother also kept her away from too many people, and she showed no interest in any of her male admirers.
I mean, I guess that's good, because showing an interest in your male admirers could get you into trouble.
Yes, and she was also good at reading audiences, and she would use that to her advantage.
Hmm. So even though she didn't have a lot of friends, she didn't have that kind of parasocial audience energy going on.
Yes. Now, Charles Frohman had a brother, Daniel, who's also in the theater production business. Daniel got a hold of a play that he handed off to his brother, and with that play he recommended Maud to Charles. You see, Daniel had been involved in the production of A Midnight Bell, and his brother took him up on contracting Maud. It started a 25-year friendship and business partnership.
It was a long time to be friends and partners.
Now, Charles Frohman wasn't showy like the stereotypes of theatrical managers at the time. He actually shunned publicity. He also might have been bi, which would have explained shunning publicity.
Mm-hmm, right? You don't want people digging in where they oughtn't.
He also paid his employees well, but was a bit of a dictator, like you absolutely had to follow what he said. In 1892, Frohman had her start alongside John Drew in The Masked Ball, the first of several plays they performed in together. They got on quite well, her usual shyness being set at ease. Though Drew initially saw her as quite frail, Maud was only 5 feet tall and weighed 100 pounds, whereas Drew was used to the more physically robust leading ladies of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she was delicate. Did this help, though, in some of her roles? I mean, I can imagine that she could lend that air of vulnerability that would be more charming to an audience sometimes.
Yes, for some of her roles. Her seriousness, intelligence, and expressive face proved him wrong, like he didn't think she was up to it. That and the fact she never missed a rehearsal or performance during the 5 years they worked together.
Mm-hmm. Right, so he's like, oh, you're a nerd about this, cool.
There was a time she found it difficult to pretend to be drunk in one scene in The Masked Ball, because she had never been drunk in her entire life.
Oh, she was too dedicated to her craft to be out partying.
Correct. Someone gave her a rose, actually, and she was waving it around topsy-turvy and decided to sort of follow it around, like, and everyone would give her a rose for each performance. And following how the rose would move was actually how she got through the pretending to be drunk. It was this scene, actually, that critics singled out as showing her as a unique and exciting performer.
Wow. So that's really, it goes against kind of the method school that is the more modern way of looking at acting, that you have to experience everything and then draw on those experiences. It sounds like she is using that old school acting technique, but doing it in a way that still feels real to a lot of people.
Now, it wasn't long after this that Maude gave a few interviews, including one where she admitted to preferring comedic roles. She was quoted as disliking being in sniveling roles for the last 2 years. Froman banned her from giving interviews after that.
Mm-hmm. Right, because I imagine as today, comedic roles aren't seen as being as like high status as the more dramatic roles that, you know, comedic roles are. Oh, they're just a walk in the park. They're so easy. You just make people laugh versus dramatic roles are what, you know, get Academy Award nominations in movies and things like that.
So yeah, even today, we have this stigma against comedy and comedic actors, where they're seen as less important or less valuable, lower status than dramas and dramatic actors, and the idea of you know, high drama or whatever. So I'm sure that it was seen as gauche or uneducated or something of her to say, well, I like doing comedy. I'm sure it would take just as much skill for her to pull comedy off as high drama.
In the next few years, people would associate her with playing clean, innocent roles, an image she would maintain throughout her career.
Which is interesting, given that professed interest in comedy, that she was both pure and also liked humor.
It was also during these years that Drew's niece, Ethel Barrymore, joined the company. She found Maude friendly and happy, but closely guarded by her mother. It didn't help that newspapers dubbed her apartment Maude Adams' Adamless Eve.
Nice.
Froman was not amused at such suggestive references to his budding star.
Yeah, no, I'd imagine. I mean, she's being sold on her innocence. And I guess that does match up with her small stature and kind of that she's being quiet, that she doesn't want to talk to interviewers. This all paints a particular image that he doesn't want to have destroyed.
Things were not helped when newspapers gossiped about Maude's supposed liaisons with other actresses.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Do we know if any of those actually happened, or was that just newspaper speculation on the idea of, well, if she's not seeing any men?
Well, so Froman was unable to verify or disprove them, as far as we know. Considering other factors in her life, she was probably a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that he probably confronted Maude over these rumors. But he also came up with a fake engagement announcement in a newspaper between her and his friend, the writer Richard Harding Davis, who was very surprised to see that article, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. You'd think he'd, like, send him a letter or something, like, hey, bro, just so you know, it's like that time that I applied to a job and I put my friend as my, reference and she didn't know. She was like, this person's been trying to call me about something? Is this spam?
Yeah, beyond that one article, it was never mentioned ever again.
Mm-hmm. It was a nice, tidy, get rid of the rumors sort of engagement.
Yeah, it was also during this time that Maude had a secretary, Lily Florence, who was probably her partner.
Interesting. Yes, secretaries.
Yes, secretary. Unfortunately, Lily would die in 1901.
That is unfortunate. Do we know anything about their relationship or what they meant to each other? Do we have anything left from that?
No, we know a bit more about her next secretary, but that's a bit of a ways in the future.
So what does Maude do after this loss?
Continue performing.
I think a lot of people end up doing that, just kind of throwing themselves into work. What does she perform in next?
Well, we have to backtrack a bit to 1896. When Maude stops playing alongside John Drew. Now, we do get a bit of a brief run-in with Sarah Bernhardt as she came to town with her own repertory company, so they had to compete for audiences. And several critics actually called Maude a young Bernhardt.
Ooh! Well, that's exciting. Now, we said in our Bernhardt episode that they nearly played together. But do we know anything else about their connection? Did they correspond? Did they talk? Do we know anything about what they said about each other?
They only talked when it came to the time they nearly performed together, which is a few years in the future from this moment.
Mm. So for now, Maude has probably heard that Sarah Bernhardt is in her city. But aside from that,
they are but ships passing each other in the night.
Yes, because now we get one of Maud's most famous roles. So in 1896, the playwright James Barry is finishing The Little Minister when he sees Maud perform in a play called Rosemary. He immediately goes to Frohman, who will be producing his play, and announces that he has found his Babby, the name of the heroine of The Little Minister. This completely launches Maud into stardom. Though first, they have to focus on fixing Maud's Scottish accent.
Oof, that sounds like it would be an endeavor.
Yeah, so at the time, it was uncommon for American plays to have foreign dialects, so this proved quite a challenge, but The Little Minister was a hit.
So I guess she got it in the end.
Oh yes, she would play Lady Babby for years afterwards, and you can actually hear a bit of her in the play on a YouTube recording, though the recording was done decades later, so her voice would have changed. It's still very girlish sounding.
Mm-hmm.
But the first night alone, there were several curtain calls, and Maud received a standing ovation for the first 2 minutes she appeared on stage, which settled her nerves as she had been worried. She'd gotten used to appearing with John Drew, the more experienced actor, who was always there just in case she would mess up, and now he was gone. This may be why she broke down crying right after getting off stage at the end. Having the nerves overwhelm her?
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I mean, she's been used to relying on someone else to kind of guide her, and now she doesn't have that guide. She's kind of on her own.
Yeah, under all the praise, which went on for weeks, she calmed down and got used to it all. She still didn't give her own interviews. Instead, Frohman would release little tidbits, some of which caused a critic to muse where stage Maud ended and real Maud began.
Oh, yeah, you're not quite sure, are you? Because all of quote-unquote real Maud that you get is real Maud filtered through that time equivalent of a publicist.
After 37 straight weeks of playing Lady Babby, she took off for a cottage in the Catskills for the summer, and she would return to play Lady Babby again in the fall. It was also during this second season that she met and later on befriended Phyllis Robbins, who would write a biography on her and receive her things after her death, which were then donated to the Harvard Theater Library. So after this tour ended, Maud convinced Frohman to let her perform Romeo and Juliet, a role that many other actresses had done, including Sarah Bernhardt.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine the comparisons to a whole host of other actresses were inevitable.
Yeah,
Frohman even warned her about this, but she insisted and persisted, though the run would be brief because of demand for The Little Minister.
That sounds like it would be kind of a lot, though, to go up against every single actress who has ever played Juliet.
Yeah, the announcement of her playing Juliet was a surprise to people, and the debate and comparison started immediately.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
But she kept rehearsing Shakespeare when not performing as Babby while on tour.
That makes sense. I mean, she so far has shown that she is dedicated to the craft, and she will rehearse everything all the time.
Oh yeah, so the play opens in 1899. And Maud was already acknowledged as the most popular actress at the time, in the U.S. at least. But while she did well at the love scenes with Romeo, she didn't do well at the end with the parting and deaths.
How come?
Critics believe she did not have much experience with the bard before with Shakespeare, neither did the leading man. It wasn't the purest of Shakespeare, despite audience still liking her. They felt she failed a bit when it came to the dramatic, tragic elements.
And it sounded like, at least earlier, that wasn't something she particularly enjoyed either, so I guess that makes sense.
But she enjoyed her challenges, which is why, though she continued to play Babby, she encountered the work of Edmond Rostand, which led to her wanting to play the doomed son of Napoleon Bonaparte in his new work, L'Aiglon, The Eaglet. Frohman reluctantly agreed to her request.
Yeah, I'm sure he's like, so you wanted to be Juliet and have yourself compared to everyone and go outside of your acting comfort zone, and now you want to play a guy. Interesting.
In the role that Sarah Bernhardt has been playing in Europe.
Mm-hmm. So, critics, not only do you want to play a guy, you want to play a guy who has already been played by, like, the top actress of our time.
Yes, critics predicted shock in audiences as Maud would go from the womanly Babby to a teenage boy.
Mm-hmm. How'd that go?
Well, first, this led Maud on a brief European tour to better understand the doomed French prince, including visiting his grave in Vienna, as his mother had been part of the Austrian royal family. And she also visited Rostand in Paris to discuss the play. She specifically avoided seeing Sarah Bernhardt playing the role in the French theater. As Maud herself would say, it was bad enough to have to play the part without being completely terrified by seeing Madame Bernhardt in it.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine, but it sounds like she is doing so much research to get this as good as possible.
Oh yeah, this is also... You could call this her first vacation since 1897, possibly. She doesn't really vacation all that often.
Well, and it doesn't really sound like this is a vacation, does it? It sounds like this is a trip she's taking for work and kind of enjoying.
Yes. She then retreats to the Catskills and her farm in Ronkonkoma. I probably messed that up. It's a very long Indian word. Anyway, it's where she has Shetland ponies and collies, and she also has a house on 41st Street in New York City, which she occasionally houses poverty-stricken actresses in. But anyway, she's focusing up there on her farm on the son of Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, while the eaglet posed an interesting challenge due to him being a complex spirit, namely a sickly young man attempting to fulfill a grand destiny set out by his now deceased father, critics were more interested in whether or not she could play a teenage boy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Looking at the superficial things, where have we seen that before?
She performed it well, though. Though some still said she wasn't quite to the point of skill with tragedy that she was with her other performances, and there were the inevitable comparisons to Bernhardt. This was not helped when they both performed the role in the same city, albeit in different languages. Bernhardt did end up switching to a different play, though, because most Americans didn't know French, and so they gravitated to the English version.
So we're actually seeing maybe Bernhardt drawing more people to Maud Adams here.
The criticism took a toll on her, though. Not enough to have her cancel performances, but still, she wasn't in the best of shape. Over the last 7 weeks of the run, though, she would miss a performance in Hartford and have to redo it as a matinee. And this sort of signaled the inevitable break from theater for a while. So after the end, she immediately returned to New York and then told no one where she went. Some said she had an appendicitis operation, others that she married Froman.
But I don't think she did, though, because it doesn't sound like there was a whole lot between them.
No. Instead, she took a ship to Calais under her birth name. From Calais, went to Paris, then to Tours, where she stayed in a convent run by the Sisters of St. Augustine. And the seclusion was just the right cure for her near depression and exhaustion.
Now, was she still a Mormon? Had she ever really connected with that? And I'm wondering, because now she's in presumably a Catholic place, and was there any kind of friction there, or did she just feel at home there?
She got on well with the nuns, though. Maud Adams herself never seems to have really been religious in any vein.
Gotcha.
She returned to the theater 3 months later to perform in another Barry play, Quality Street. However, upheaval followed as Froman admitted Bernhardt wanted to play Romeo and Juliet. With herself as Romeo and Maud as Juliet.
Sounds pretty gay, just gonna say it.
Maud reacted with trepidation.
Oh, because of her previous run-ins with critics about Juliet's death scene.
That and probably playing opposite Bernhardt, getting a bit of nerves here.
Yeah, it'd be a bit scary.
So originally, Bernhardt announced this plan, if she could learn Romeo in English, and it would be appearing in the fall of 1902. Critics doubted the two women could share a stage.
I mean, yeah, because they have some very intense stuff going on. Each of them is, I think, doing different styles, is that right?
Yes, they're doing different styles and different languages. Also, knowing critics, we must have dueling divas.
Right, no, women can never get along with each other. They must always hate each other and destroy each other. They can't just support each other.
Yes, we don't know what Maud thought of this. What we do know is that Bernhardt later on said she couldn't do it in English, and Maud sent a telegram reading, "I'll do it in French. Who's afraid?"
Of course, I love it. But then they still never did it. So what happened?
So Bernhardt accepted this new plan, but It just languished. It was never performed. And we can sit here a century later in disappointment.
Yeah, and still wonder why.
Well, you see, Maud had worked herself into exhaustion again. This time, a nervous breakdown and took off on another rest, so... That has something to do with it.
Yeah, that would make sense.
So keep in mind, she's practically been performing nonstop for 17 years, aside from those 3 months in tours at the convent. So now she takes off to St. Moritz, Switzerland, and she's there for 4 months. She does not return to the theater after that, and instead goes to her farm. Later on, she would travel with a nurse and companion to Italy, Egypt, and Jerusalem. At one point, she actually visited Luxor and Karnak at the same time as the Queen of Austria, who then invited her to dine.
Ooh, okay. No imposter syndrome at all then, I'm sure.
So it's only in the summer of 1903 that she returns to the U.S., reinvigorated and ready to perform again. Even her mother acknowledged that she was incredibly energized. The play chosen was similar to previous ones, but Maud was uncertain of her ability for it. She'd had a good long look at her career up to this point. While she enjoyed her artistic progress, she had no desire to continue playing the same character type. She had fallen into the trap that all actors detest. She had been typecast.
No, not that. Anything but that.
Yes, and she vehemently disliked it. So for 2 years now, she's been running her own life, and it's empowered her. A new boldness that... amazed the men around her, and she realized having her personal life separated so much from her career was great. Which is how, according to Ethel Barrymore, she became the pre-Greta Garbo, the original I-want-to-be-alone woman. Admittedly, this is probably for the best, as she would meet Louise Boyton in 1905 and be involved with her until Boyton's death in 1951.
Yeah, so you don't want people to know about that, now do you?
Though she would continue trying some new plays, she was also still portraying Lady Babby, including on a tour west through Salt Lake City and San Francisco. The governor of Utah actually came out and gave a speech during that tour and gave her a large cup full of champagne for her achievements.
Nice! Also, though, Utah and alcohol are not usually synonymous in my mind. There's this whole thing about, like, you can't... I don't remember the exact law, and I don't know if it's still a thing, but that... you can't pour your own wine if you go to a restaurant. The server has to pour it for you. It's like this whole thing because they're so anti-alcohol. I guess they make exceptions for actresses.
Perhaps. Life being a roller coaster, though, she couldn't get off that easily. She developed a pain in her abdomen, and in spring 1904, she was rushed to the hospital for an emergency appendectomy. She nearly died.
Wow. Okay. Also, can we just say that former... potential medical thing was not appendicitis, clearly.
Yeah, and people weren't certain if she would recover enough in time to perform Barry's latest play, Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you've heard of her before, you know what happened.
Oh yes, they didn't have to worry. The play opened in 1905, didn't find its footing for a few weeks, but was soon a success, perhaps in part because Maud got the audience so strongly involved with the revival of Tinkerbell by getting them to yell they believe in fairies till the house felt like it would come down.
Yeah, and that is, if for anyone who has ever seen the play live, a really magical moment. So I love that she was the originator of that audience enthusiasm.
The play would add children to Maud's most fervent fans alongside women. It came with a deluge of fan mail asking questions like whether or not they could learn to fly or if she could send them fairy dust. The play would run through Christmas matinees where Maud treated the cast to a party and $15 in envelopes signed Tinkerbell.
Aww, it's cute.
Not all the attention was positive, though. So, for instance, she got a speeding ticket while in a rush to make one evening's performance. It cost her $200 and necessitated the car and chauffeur being held hostage for the evening by the police.
No!
There was also a stalker.
Who stalks Peter Pan?
Apparently, Maurice Gottlieb, who supplied the lights and other technical effects for Tinkerbell in the play.
Well, that's inconvenient.
So he came to believe that Maud loved him, that her smiles at the audience were for him, and that he heard her complimenting him.
Oh, dude, be chill about that. Just be chill.
He wrote many letters, which she discarded. He also stopped a trip to California after having a dream of Maude calling him back to New York City, where he then telegraphed her about it.
No, thank you, dude.
She made a call to the Bellevue Hospital, who picked him up.
Mm-hmm. Of course, by that time, they probably still didn't have good care for mentally ill people, so I hope that he was all right in the long term.
He seems to have been treated for the rest of his life.
Well, we'll hope that that was actually treatment and not quote-unquote treatment.
Then, of course, there was the fact that the lesbian Mercedes DaCosta would hang out backstage after the show. A gossip newspaper linked Maude to DaCosta's activities.
Do we know if there was, in fact, activity going on?
Not for certain, but Frohman was naturally not pleased.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's not part of his innocent little girl Maude image.
No, and this culminated in him hiring a new secretary for Maude, the 37-year-old Louise Boynton, a New Englander who had run a small newspaper with her sister that reviewed New York plays.
Mm-hmm. And of course she would keep Maude out of that dangerous sapphism, wouldn't she?
Oh, most certainly. No sarcasm here whatsoever, officer.
Mm-hmm. Nothing to see here, folks.
Moving along, the next problem was her mother. At the end of 1906, a former Utah senator was shot by an enraged mistress after he refused to marry her, and this mistress had found letters to the senator from Annie Adams, which led the woman to believe the man was going to marry Annie and not her.
Was that the case?
She might have indeed been about to marry the man, but either way, she was now involved in the murder trial. Having this press around Maude wouldn't do, and Frohman fired Annie and banned her from New York for the time being.
Wow, harsh. What happened to any publicity is good publicity.
That is never the case with Maude Adams.
No, you're right. I was gonna say, I would think for her mother that would be a great asset to her acting career. You know, notorious actress involved in murder trial. Everyone would go to see that play no matter what it was.
Not when Maude has such a clean image.
I mean, okay. I'm pretty sure people would still definitely go to see something after Maude has such a clean image. And you're like, ooh, are the speculations true? Is she involved in this murder somehow? But the problem, I would imagine, would be that it's not sustainable. That after that, you just have a besmirched actress. You no longer have anything marketable. You have that one play, and then that's it.
Come 1908, she was invited by Harvard's English department to perform Twelfth Night in the role of Viola.
Haha! So now we kind of unify her pants roles and her skirts roles.
Yes, we do. It's also one of the events that convinces her to add outdoor pageants to her career.
Ooh, that sounds nice.
This led to her outdoor production of Joan of Arc in 1909 at the Harvard Stadium. Maude herself went over every detail from scenery and lighting to the placement of the orchestra at the back of the stage. 15,000 people attended, and the Harvard football field had been turned into a French battlefield.
Wow! Okay, so this is a big production.
It was a magnificent success after years of Maude studying the character of Joan of Arc.
Well, it sounds like, too, like, she has got a lot of experience for the other things, the setting the scene, as it were.
Yes, at age 38, many people saw her as at the apex of her career. Her stage persona was tirelessly analyzed, but her private life was a mystery. Frohman continued to be her public protector, but she was very much her own boss, selecting dramas and creating entire productions herself. She was also the richest actress in America at this time, earning about $4 million a year in today's currency.
Dang. All right, so she's doing all right for herself.
One of her next plays would be Chantecler, which to me is just an odd play. It's about barnyard animals, and she plays a rooster who thinks the sun won't come up without his call, until one day he's late getting out of bed with a pheasant hen and realizes the sun doesn't revolve around his schedule. Critics refrained from sharing my bemusement and instead focused on how she fell flat in such a masculine role.
Mm-hmm, because that's the problem. Did people just have different tastes back then? Because it just sounds a bit silly if it's not, like, or is it a kid's play?
I don't think it's a kid's play.
Just sounds very weird. It reminds me of the time that I saw a small theater production where it was five characters and they were all dogs and all the actors were dogs and they were singing and dancing and they were dogs, and I just couldn't help but think, did you go to drama school for this? Is this the crowning achievement for you? I don't see how she could have taken that seriously, let alone the critics, but to each their own.
So, it's now 1914 and film companies have been approaching Frohman about having Maud on camera. Frohman liked the idea. Maud did not.
Oh, why not?
She adamantly refused to leave the stage for the newly created silver screen. In fact, she got Frohman and Barry to agree that the plays she had been in would never be adapted for the film.
Wow. Strong stance. Is it that she just loves the stage that much? Or does she have any experience with film that she doesn't like?
She hasn't had any experience with film. She's very much a stage actress and she doesn't want to lose royalties.
Fair enough, yeah.
Though the war in Europe hadn't affected Maud yet, it came home in 1915. The ship Frohman took to England to discuss a Newbery play was the Lusitania.
Oh, oof, yeah.
He didn't survive the German torpedoes. Maud got the news on May 8th while playing in Kansas City. It changed the trajectory of her career. His unique abilities had shaped her life on stage beyond being a mentor, and he was also a friend. Naturally, the press started rumors about whether the two were ever married.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which, there was that time he said they could have been, potentially, maybe, if it weren't for the fact that she was a lesbian.
All rumors were denied through official press statements. And now a man named Alf Heyman was now in charge, and he was not as easily convinced as Frohman was of doing things Maud's way, as evidenced by her next season only being a repertory tour. And the bad news just kept coming. In December, she got word that her grandmother had died, and her grandmother had always been the one who most understood her. So she grieved deeply, and then her mother died the next year.
Wow! That's gotta be rough on you. Did she get to take any time off after this?
Nope. She went right into performing A Kiss for Cinderella in 1916. So another Barry play.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least she still has Barry.
Yeah, her success, though, couldn't prevent more tragedy. Audiences started to decline into 1918. People mused over whether she was losing her touch with audiences. Then she caught the Spanish flu in the fall of 1918, followed by another nervous breakdown.
Man, she just does not have the luck, does she?
No, and remember when I said Maud didn't have the most robust health? It would contribute to the abrupt ending of her career. She instructed Boyton to find a secluded spot like she had found at that convent 17 years earlier. There seems to be a cycle of just 17 years of constant work, immediate breakdown, work
so for like another the opposite 17 of a years. She works for 17 years and then she goes underground.
No comment on cicadas. So she stays with the Sisters of Senecal in New York City. They had a building occupying an entire block that she wouldn't have to leave in order to have peace and quiet. Maud would stay there until early 1920. Now she gets out and she initially accepts another Barry play only to turn it down because the role required an actress in her 20s and the husband and son parts were longer and more exacting. She only wanted stellar roles now.
Mm-hmm. She's gotten to that point in her career where she knows she's good.
Yeah, and she had also become disenchanted with the Frohman Company and didn't care for Alf Heyman as her manager. And her request to change managers was declined.
Is that legal?
They also tried to get her to sign over her rights to the Barry plays so they could be sold to motion picture companies. Not surprisingly, she quit over all of this.
Mm-hmm. Wow, but what's she gonna do now? I mean, she's just lost her, like, major way of life.
Well, she would solicit a couple of ideas from playwrights, but she would never really perform again. Instead, she now indulged her interests in stage lighting. So she went to the General Electric Laboratories and worked on stage lighting, despite having no scientific training. She would also work on lighting mechanics for films. And due to her genius in the lighting lab, General Electric tried to get her to sign a contract to set up a new lab focused solely on theatrical lighting. It would have her name and be run by her. It would also would have made her very rich.
Mm-hmm.
She refused.
Why?
Solving these problems was a hobby for her and nothing more. General Electric would go on to manufacture her creation anyway, and she never sued them even though her lawyer said she had a solid case.
But I guess she just didn't want to be involved with that. She didn't want it to be her job.
Also during this time, she's invited to Union College's 125th commencement, where they gave an honorary Doctor of Laws degree making her the first woman to receive an honorary degree from that college. She also gave her Ronkonkoma estate to the Senticle organization when she heard they were overcrowded. Many thought she would become a nun. She did not.
Even though that would be perfectly on brand for her.
If you want nuns, you have to wait till November.
I'm glad we have that lined up.
In 1926, she also did a series of autobiographical stories for the Ladies' Home Journal, all in third person. This is where her essay about the one she knew least comes from. Then, after 13 years off the stage, she briefly returns for Shakespeare in 1931 and 1934, but then she becomes an acting professor at Stevens College in Missouri.
Oh, wow. Does that work for her? Does she like it?
Oh, yeah, she enjoys it, and it's very influential, her teachings. David Selznick, though, who's a producer, tries to get her on film for The Young at Heart. This is the closest you ever get to Maude on the screen, because you can find footage of the screen tests on the internet still.
Mm-hmm.
Inevitably, though, she declined the role, sticking to her ban on film roles. Maude would again fall ill in 1947, but she would continue teaching until 1949, when she retreated to the Catskills with Louise Boynton. Boynton would die unexpectedly in her sleep of a heart attack in 1951, and Maude would remain in near total seclusion and working on a few of her projects, including an anthology of dramatic works, which ceased being worked on after Boynton's death, until her own death in 1953, also of a heart attack.
Do we know anything about their life together, when they were living together? Do we have any evidence or anything left behind?
So they're actually buried in the same grave to this day.
So we don't really know a lot about their life together, but we know that they meant a lot to each other.
Yes, we also know that 100 nuns attended her simple funeral in Ronkonkoma a few days after she died.
So I guess if nothing else, she was popular among the nun community.
Yes, though famed in her day and the inventor of and solver of many film and theater lighting problems, Maude Adams is almost forgotten today.
And despite her influential Peter Pan role that taught everyone else how to do it.
But remember, when you hide your sapphic ways, don't be surprised when the press try to marry you off to your manager.
And if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe. We've plenty more to entertain you.